You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Welcome to the Stone Tapes. I'm Sam Stone, and in the studio with me today is Patricia H. Ash.
Hello.
David J. Howe.
Gotcha.
And Mr. George Mann.
Hello.
And on the telephone, luckily today, we have Robin Pearce. And welcome back, Robin.
Yay. Hey, yay. Thank you. Thanks for having me back, guys.
Oh, we've
Fantastic.
Missed you.
We've missed you, Robin.
We know you've been too busy to spend time with us, but we're so glad that you're back.
Glad to be back.
But, of course, we've heard about your little accident.
Oh,
and how are you feeling?
Not too bad. Immobilised, but going through DVDs like a superstar, like a trooper.
Oh, that's fantastic. So for our listener, you've basically torn a ligament in your leg or ankle or calf.
No. It was my own fault. I chose not to take a shortcut. Oh, sorry, I chose to take a shortcut. I ran up a grass bank and virtually my calf muscle exploded, leaving me with
goodness.
A 4-inch gap.
Oh, my God.
It would have been easier had I broken a bone, say the hospital.
Oh, good grief, that's horrible.
Anyway,
and,
yes.
And how long are you looking at for recovery on that?
It was 3 weeks ago today. Back at the hospital tomorrow to get another cast on and potentially looking at about another 5-6 weeks.
Good grief.
Gosh. Yeah.
Well, at least you are on the show. And what are you going to talk to us about this time?
Well, you know, during my downtime, my layoff period, I've been indulging myself completely in the anniversary of something that is very, very dear to me, which is, of course, Star Trek. Now, you guys know this because you had me interviewing Garrett Wong at the Sci-Fi.
We did indeed.
Theater. Best moments of the year so far for me. But, you know, really, can we believe that Star Trek is 50 years since it was first broadcast in America? Now, I believe, David, you might be able to help me out here. It wasn't broadcast in the UK till about 1970.
I think it was 1969. I think it was the tail end.
I think it was just at the end of the Patrick Troughton run of Doctor Who, wasn't it?
That's right.
That time slot.
I've got a feeling, that they replaced Doctor Who with Star Trek in 1969. So when Pat regenerated into John Pertwee, then the next week we had Star Trek. So, yeah.
That's right. And Captain James T. Kirk took to the airwaves here in the UK. But by the time we'd seen it, it had already been cancelled for a year in the US.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That is amazing.
But it was a ratings flop when it first came out in the US because they kept changing its time slot, and it only actually became popular in the 1970s when it was sold to syndication, and that's when it became the huge blockbuster that it is today. But, you know, the difference between Star Trek and science fiction, American science fiction of the time, which basically was Irwin Allen and
his
Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Lost in Space, Time Tunnel, fantastic entertainment, you know, didn't give a flying fig for science. Whereas Star Trek was, of course, written by science fiction authors. You had people like, David Gerald, Theodore Sturgeon.
Harlan Ellison.
Harlan Ellison, absolutely. The City on the Edge of Forever. An episode which, incidentally, he completely disowns now because they wouldn't do it the way that he wanted to. And when he found out the script revisions, he actually tipped Gene Roddenberry's desk over and stormed out of the room.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, goodness, I didn't know that. I didn't know any of that. But it does kind of show you how why it's so good, because it was written by all of these amazing people.
It was, and they never made large of the gadgets, because it was meant to be a wagon train to the stars, which is how Gene Roddenberry sold it to begin with, homing in on the network's proliferation of westerns at the time.
Mm.
And, of course, Wagon Train to the Stars, when you think about it, actually fits Battlestar Galactica better.
Yes.
Because,
yes.
You know, got the whole trail thing. But they wanted the bridge of the Enterprise and the sick bay and the corridors and all of it to be as familiar to viewers as, say, the living room in the Ponderosa on Bonanza.
Yes. Mm.
So, you know, and the way they brought in several sort of things that had never been done on TV before, like having an alien front and centre, but a subtly made-up one with just the ears and the eyebrows. And the way they got Nichelle Nichols to come in, I thought was genius at the time.
Mm. Yes.
Remember, it's 1966.
Yes.
Roddenberry tells the network executives he wants to bring more colour onto the bridge. And they honestly thought they were going to have more bright lights and flashing lights and diodes. And he brings on this black lady. How cool is that?
So cool.
Do you know, I think this is what's so iconic about Star Trek, is because they were way ahead of their time at that time with making it all inclusive. And it was so politically correct in that sense.
They were.
Know. Rather than
she was a lieutenant as well.
She was.
She was. Yes, she was one of the command crew. But the big news at the moment is next year we'll see another Star Trek series on the airwaves.
Mm. Yes,
I'm excited.
Very excited.
Star Trek Discovery. Too. Now I've been scouring the internet trying to find out about this, and details are very sparse. We know that the uniforms won't follow the Enterprise overall things that they had, you know, with Scott Bakula and mm-hmm. all that. They're going to be the gold, blue and red that we saw on the original Star Trek series.
Yes.
Ah.
It's actually going to be set 100 years ahead of James Kirk's adventures.
Well, after,
I like that. Sorry, 100 years before
after.
That.
Before James Kirk.
James Kirk. Wow.
Before, around the time of The Cage.
Uh-huh.
The original series pilot.
Yes.
Don't tell him,
we
Pike.
Know Captain Pike, yes. Jeffrey Hunter. We do know that the linchpin for the first season's 13 episodes, going to be a much shorter series, this one, will be the Balance of Terror episode from season one, which brought the Romulans into the Star Trek lore.
Right.
So they are going to be at war with the Romulans. It's going to follow the Prime timeline, i.e., you know, William Shatner, Picard, and all the rest, not the last films that were kicked off by J.J. Abrams with Chris Pine, which is, I believe, known as the Kelvin timeline. So that's being ignored, possibly because of the really bad box office receipts it's received. But it's certainly something to look forward to.
Well, thank you, Robin. That's fantastic.
You're welcome.
We're going to let you go now, but we're going to call you back very shortly because we'd like to talk to you about our film of the month.
Awesome. I will leave you with a piece. Live long and prosper, and I will talk to you later.
Prosper, Robin.
Across the universe
on the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk.
Star Trekking across the universe,
only going forward cause we can't find reverse.
Life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it. It's Captain.
Yeah.
life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it.
Yep. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, Jim.
Starship Captain James G.
Ah, we come in peace, shoot to kill, shoot to kill, shoot to kill. We come in peace, shoot to kill, shoot to kill, ma'am.
It's worse than that, he's dead, Jim. Worse than that, he's dead, Jim.
Well, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it, not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow. Scrape them off, Jim.
Star trekking across the universe.
On the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk.
Star trekking across the universe.
Oh, we come in peace, shoot to kill, shoot to kill, shoot to kill. We come in peace, shoot to kill. Scotty, beam me up.
It's worse than that, he's dead, Jim. Dead, Jim. Dead, Jim. It's worse than that, he's dead, Jim. Dead, Jim. Dead.
Well, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Not as we know it. Not as we know it. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Not as we know it, Captain.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow.
You kind of change your script, Jim. Off to you, Jimmy.
It's worse than that, it's physics, Jim.
Bridge to engine room, warp factor 9.
Oh, if I give it any more, she'll blow.
Absolutely mental. And with that, we're heading over to Patricia's Corner. Patricia, what are you going to review for us this week?
Well, we're going to go totally... Here's something completely different.
That's
sounds
great,
good.
A great big bare foot squashes down on the rest
exactly.
of the stone tapes.
Sorry you got squished by the foot. It was supposed to go over... Anyway, from Star Trek, which I love and adore, and I'm looking forward to the next series. And from that to witches. I reviewed one of my favorite movies, The Craft.
Oh.
Yes. So it's a horror movie about teenagers, witches who are teenagers, you know. And about what you would expect to happen when you give teenagers incredible cosmic power happens in the movie. Yeah, don't give teenagers incredible cosmic power ever. So there's this girl, Sarah, and she moves to Los Angeles and befriends some other girls who happen to be witches. And then with Sarah as their fourth, their little coven has actual power. So things start happening. And at first it's good things, like the one with the scars. They do a spell, and then her scars go away. They kind of peel off like a bad sunburn. And good things happen, you know. It's like any wish fulfillment story. At first, it's awesome, and then things start going wrong. One of the girls, the goth one, Nancy, she's a very, very angry person. And... she starts using her powers to punish people who she thinks deserve it. Someone gets killed, and then Sarah goes, "Hey, wait a minute. Maybe we should stop and think about what we're doing." Of course, Nancy, being a teenager and a very angry one, is very, "If you're not with me, you're against me." So at that point, Nancy starts trying to kill Sarah. And I'm not going to say the rest of the movie because that might spoil it.
Yes.
And one of the things I really like about this movie is that they had an on-set Wiccan consultant.
Wow.
Oh,
so the witchcraft, while I've never met any Wiccans who have the kind of very vivid cinematic powers that the girls have, it's actually pretty accurate.
I remember one bit, because I have seen this film, and I do, like you, love this film, where Sarah, I think it is, discovers glamour, and she changes her hair colour by running her hands over her face. And I always stuck with me. I always thought that was a wonderful scene.
Yeah, and then one of the other girls, Rochelle, is like, well, that's cheaper than going to a salon.
Exactly. So therefore you get the humour in it as well.
Yeah, Rochelle is pretty much there to be just, occasionally comic relief and say sorts of things.
Do you think it's got some dark elements to this film? Is it very dark, or is it just on the surface dark?
No.
Is there a moral?
Moral is don't mess with things that are very, very powerful. If I were going to say that there was a moral to the story, don't mess with things that are very, very powerful. But, wait, what was the question?
How dark is it? Is it a very dark story?
I would say that it is pretty dark, because even Sarah, the good guy, causes some things to happen that are very not good.
Mm. Yes.
To put it, yeah.
And I think it's very much about temptation, isn't it? Because suddenly you discover you've got this gift, and you might have all the best intentions of using it well, but then, you know, all of our human nature comes into play. And we want to do other things with it.
Should also probably think before you cast a love spell on somebody. Because that can go very, very wrong. And in the movie, it does go very, very, very wrong. So just sort of think before...
Casting.
That's
It's an adage for life, that, really, isn't it?
It is.
Think before you cast a spell.
Yeah,
think
absolutely. So what are you going to give that out of 10?
9.5 out of 10.
Wow, that's a good score. Anyway, if you fancy seeing the film is, again?
The Craft.
And what era was that made in?
It was made in the 90s.
I thought it was around the 90s.
Yeah.
And it is a great film, so check it out if you can find it out there. It's worth a
watch. It's on Netflix.
Oh, it's on Netflix? Oh, well, mm-hmm. That's even better, because I'm going to have to watch it again now.
She packed my bags. Last night, pre-flight. 0 hour. 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high. As a kite by then. Oh, I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. Such a timeless flight. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. To touchdown brings me back again to find I'm not the man they think I am back home. Oh no, 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 I'm a rocket man. Rocket Man, burning out his fumes out here, alone. I think it's gonna be a long, long time, till touchdown bring me round again and find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, 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 I'm a Rocket Man. Rocket Man. Burning out his fuse out here alone. Mars ain't the kind of place to raise a kid. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there to raise him. If you did, I don't understand. It's just a job. 5 days a week. Rocket Man. A Rocket Man. think it's gonna be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me around again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh no, no, no. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out his fuse out here. Hello. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am. Oh, oh, no, no. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man. Burning out his fuse out here alone. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. And I think it's gonna be long, long time.
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. You're listening to Siren FM.
To be you.
It is me, Tom Stevens, Siren Simply Jazz. Join me Tuesday mornings 11 to 12:30, repeated Sunday evenings 9 to 10:30 on Siren FM. Great music from the big band era, interviews and features. Some of those tracks you may not have heard in quite a while. Tom Stevens, Siren Simply Jazz.
Had to be you.
Oh, and that was very William Shatner with a bit of Rocket Man. God, guys, what do we
awesome.
Think?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it.
It's just so unique and distinctive, isn't it? It's fabulous.
So unique. That was a great introduction to, I think, something we're going to go over to the Man Factor now, but we're not going to talk about Star Trek again now, are we?
No, another segue.
Take it sideways.
I thought it would be interesting to have a conversation about genre today, because I'm at a point where I'm thinking about what book I want to write next. I'm coming to the end of a project, which marks the end of a series for me as well. And I'm kind of going, well, what am I going to do next? Do I want to do something different? Do I want to do something that's in the same area? So I've started to have a think about other possible projects and a little bit of research. And one thing that I'm quite interested in exploring is a thriller. So I've been reading a lot of thrillers. And I've been watching a lot of kind of thriller films like Mission Impossible and things like that. And one thing that struck me about them all, really, is that they're all very much based on the same template. Mm. In fact, to the extent that I was watching trailers for a recent movie at the cinema, and I saw there was a new Jack Reacher film and a new Bourne film and some other film that I'd lost track of because it was basically the same story again. And yes. I kind of thought, and that, so I've kind of got to a place where I've been wondering about genre and what our perceptions of genre are and whether it's actually helpful for a writer to work within a genre, or whether it's better to tell a story the way that you artistically want to tell a story, but then you might find that you're butting against the genre that you're trying to sell to.
What was your observations, George, of this template? What did you observe? What is the template for a thriller? Can you summarise that?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because there's a book called Save the Cat, which talks about this kind of Hollywood structure of films, and it's very much that's in play in all of these thrillers. It's particularly at the moment, you've got these older heroes being dragged back, male heroes generally, dragged back into the field because, you know, there's a threat that only they
like
can deal
Red
with.
And Red 2, for example, because they're all older heroes.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're brought back because they've got this specialist ability and they've still got it and they're still the hero and they can still get the girl. And the world's depending on them. And it's usually a MacGuffin that actually doesn't matter. It could be like someone's been kidnapped or there's a bomb or, you know, It's like all of those kind of classic tropes.
So is the thriller then, if the actual reason for the story is a MacGuffin, is the thriller then more about the characters and how they grow and evolve?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that's striking me about them is it tends to be the same character journey.
Oh, interesting.
So it's that whole thing of the guy wasn't really happy in his family life, or he wasn't really happy retired, and he needed to get back in the field because that's the thing that he can do.
He's got to solve something in his life.
He's got to solve, and it solves something in his life. And it's and at the end, he's generally reconciled with his family life, but having a duplicitous life of going out and saving the world as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I kind of immediately attracts me about that is to go, well, what if you invert that and go, what if you put a woman in that position and have a woman leading the thriller? You don't see a lot of female action kind of thrillers like that. There are some out there, of course there are.
So if you were to write a thriller, what you're concerned about is would you as the writer be straitjacketing yourself by trying to follow the formula that you've seen, or would it be better to just do a thriller in George Mann style?
Yeah, and that's the thing, that's the question I'm wrestling with, because on one hand ago I can see there's a really clear formula that people obviously love it, and they want to buy those books. That's publishers and readers.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, I kind of go, but I'd quite like to do one with a female lead and put some twists
in
it.
Well, I think that's an even better idea altogether.
But then you get to the point, you go, well, I've broken the formula then, so is that going to sell? Are the publishers going to turn around and go, well, this isn't a thriller in the traditional sense? Are readers going to react differently to it? Is it a predominantly male marketplace, the people who read those, who want to read about a man who they can, you know, pretend it's them?
What's your thoughts on it, David?
Well, I think it depends on, as a writer, I mean, do you want to write what you want to write, or do you want to write stuff that will sell? I know that might sound a bit dichotomous, but I mean, at the end of the day, I think that there are writers out there who write for consumption, who perhaps don't necessarily 100% believe in what they're writing, but they write what their publishers want them to write, or what they have pre-sold, or, you know, or whatever it might be. You also have writers out there who write what they want to write, and the books are distinctive and different and quirky. The difficulty, as you say, is it's if you write what you want to write and then find that actually no one wants to buy that.
it kind of gets a bit
problematic. I think there's room for both. I think that you know, the whole thing can kind of benefit. It's an interesting one, though.
I think it's good to be a trailblazer and do things differently as well. You never know where that can lead.
Well, I agree, and I think looking, you know, further into it and mulling it over recently, I've been kind of thinking, actually, most of the things that stand out to me as great pieces of art in terms of writing and film tend to be things where people have put genres together.
Yes.
And Star Trek's a great example. Yeah. We've just been talking about how it's essentially a Western in space.
Mm. I never thought that either. That surprised me.
But if Jane Roddenberry hadn't done that, that's a whole genre of cinema that would have, TV and cinema that would have disappeared. And I think what's interesting for me is that those, like you say, they're trailblazer moments where people go, let's put these two things together, create a genre. And then what tends to happen is people then put rules around that, and then it starts to
become quite strict.
It's like space opera.
It's a subgenre again.
is another case in point. It's like the soap operas mixed with science fiction.
What an interesting thought.
It is very interesting. I think you have to be true to yourself. I mean, I think, when when I was commissioning the Doctor Who novellas for Telos way back in the day, I remember having a discussion with Kim Newman about him doing the first one that we published, Time and Relative. And Kim was obviously concerned because he was like, well, you know, what do you want? I said, well, what I want is I want a Kim Newman book. It was like, I want a Kim Newman book first and foremost that just happens to be a Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
So if I, you know, and I think I said, you know, if I wanted perfectly acceptable, really good Doctor Who, I could ask Terence Dix to write them all because he can do that and he's awesome at it. But I wanted a Kim Newman book, and that's why I wanted Kim Newman to bring something different.
And again, if you look at Doctor Who, a lot of the best Doctor Who stories are the ones that do something different with it.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think, as you, George Mann, a writer, I think if you want to write a thriller, you want to write a thriller that's the way I'll go. Yeah.
It's been interesting to get to that decision point by going through and looking at a genre and thinking, wow, it's quite a strict set of rules that's developed around this thing, and, you know,
I really admire actually the fact that you've looked into it to such a degree as well and explored those rules. Because me, I just go, oh, I'm going to write a thriller and I just do whatever I thought a thriller was.
I don't necessarily, I mean, think that's a bad thing. I think that's, you know.
Yeah, but it might be completely wrong.
You probably turn up with something book, great at the be. End of it.
Yeah. I think this is absolutely a subject that we need to come back to.
Again, and in fact, most of the man factor subjects.
Yeah, they are.
Sorry, I come in with these, trying to have these lofty conversations.
We've got our own little panels going here.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
But now I think we're going to go to a little trailer for our next bit.
Oh my God, is she so sad to die alone on the 4th? Shadows are trailing. My heart is bewailing and tolling within like a funeral bell. Rest in peace, Mrs. Jones.
What are you doing?
I was just reciting some Longfellow. I think it's nice to say a few things before.
Why did you open her eyes?
That's what you do when someone dies, to let their soul rise up to heaven.
What? No, no, you close their eyes.
Okay. Trust me on this one.
No, trust me, okay? Nobody does it that way.
You're gonna feel pretty silly when the internet's back up.
Please, this was a sweet old lady, all right? Don't be weird. Just leave her in peace. Stop it.
Oh, taking control. Yeah, I dig it. But I gotta do right by her. Let your soul be free.
You're being ridiculous.
No, you're being ridiculous. And let go of my wrist. You're hurting me.
I'm not touching you.
And what you were listening to then was an extract from a brilliant movie that David and I found this week. And it's called Night of the Living Dead, which in itself is a very provocative title, I thought.
Yes.
David, what channel was it that you discovered this little gem?
I think it was on the Horror Channel. And it's Night of the Living Dead. So it's not Dead, it's Deb.
Deb. Did I not sound, make it...
Deborah.
Pronounced.
We found it on the Horror Channel, and it was a Fright Fest presentation. And I believe this film was one of the Fright Fest presentations, I think last year. Maybe Kyle can help us with that. But I think it was last year. So,
well, what happened was we watched this wonderful movie. And then as these things go, I got onto social media and thought, this is fantastic. And the reason it was fantastic, it was because it was extremely well cast. It was a very together story, not always what mm-hmm. we find with things we randomly find on the TV. And it had the amazing Ray Wise in there, of course, who's always good value. And David tweeted that he really liked the movie, and he got a response from the writer-director himself, Kyle Rankin. And I believe Kyle's on the phone. Hello, Kyle.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi. Thank you so much for responding to us. We thought our viewers would quite like to, our listeners would quite like to hear the story behind us getting in contact with you. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm honoured to be on. So, yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, we're really interested in the origins of this story and the thought process that went behind it. So you're the writer of the Night of Living Deb. And I'll say that again, Deb, it is not dead. So what were you thinking when you came to write this for the very first time? What were you looking to do?
Mostly to have a strong role for an older woman. You know, Maria Thayer doesn't look it, but I believe she just turned 40, and it was
wow.
So really, yeah.
Wow.
So she looks amazing, and so it was really. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Shaun of the Dead, so it was really. I was just kind of, you know, thinking over what hadn't I seen before, and I kind of thought I hadn't seen kind of a female protagonist, like a female version of that, basically. And it was such a low budget movie that I didn't think would really go anywhere. That I thought, well, then I'll steal their brilliant idea at the title and kind of just rework the title for this kind of loony character named Deborah. And it just ended up being a delightful process from beginning to end. I raised the money on Kickstarter, so it was only a little over $100,000 US dollars. But I just Yeah, thanks for the compliment about the casting, because I think I was just so impressed with the cast. I think Maria Sayer did a great job.
We thought she was wonderful.
Maria was absolutely amazing. This is David, Kyle. Hi.
Yeah, hi.
She kind of holds the whole film together. I think there are scenes in which she's not in, but there's not many of them.
Yes, no, and if it's not her in a scene, I definitely leaned on Ray Wise, who I've known for, I think, like 15 years now. He's a lovely person, and I know, you know, if he's the only other guy that I would trust. So, like, okay, if Maria isn't in this scene, let's have a showcase for Ray. But I totally agree. I mean, I think it's a real just fun, you know, and yet a tour de force for Maria. I think
absolutely,
she just really holds the whole thing together, yeah.
And she's such a quirky character in that she's... She sort of seems very sweet and innocent, but she's actually got a very acerbic kind of wit and a cunningness to her. And you're never quite, she's very watchable. You're never quite sure what she's going to do next.
But yet she does have so many redeeming qualities.
Absolutely.
She's adorable, actually.
Yes.
You start to watch it first and think, where is this going to go? You know, what's this? But she, I mean, she's just a girl from my own heart, really. I think she's just amazing. And the performance by Maria was absolutely essential, and she was excellent in it.
Mm. And was
she said a funny thing to me once. She said, you know, I had no idea how to play the part until I got on set, and I put on Deb's wardrobe, which was also very quirky. And she's like, I looked at myself in the mirror, and she just said to herself, okay, I now know what to do. And whatever she was doing, you know, I find the more I direct, I think this is my sixth feature, the less I say. So I really said very little to my cast. I just let them do their thing. And her thing was so charming right out of the gate that I just, okay, if I say anything, I'm just going to mess this up. So I was just there to,
provide
a safe space.
How did you find Maria in the first place? Did you already know her?
Yeah, well, I live out here in L.A. I kind of cast this myself, but the first, I knew I wanted to have Ray Wise because he's like my good luck charm. I have him in everything. And then Michael Cassidy, so I cast the male lead second.
Oh, he was fabulous. I thought he was really...
Yeah.
Well, he was very dishy as well, which helps, because he was very attractive.
And quite bemused through most of the film. He was great.
And he just started asking... We both started asking friends, hey, who do you know? Who do you think could be this... Because I was nervous about the character on the page. I knew that I liked, but I thought to myself, who's going to play this? And then Maria showed up for a coffee and, you know, kind of tripped on her way to the table. And I'm like, oh my God, this is Deb. And then we just all laughed for about 3 hours straight. And I said, she's the character. If we can, if I can just point the camera at her, then I've done my job. So, And I knew from that first meeting.
So was the whole budget $100,000?
Yeah, a little bit more. I foolishly thought I could do the whole thing for that, and then raised not much more than that from some investors. But it's a very low budget movie. And then Icon, Alan at FrightFest really liked it, and then he got Icon involved. So the UK and Ireland distribution is handled by Icon, and then it just came out here. It was actually released over there first. And then it just came out in the States a couple of days ago.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Wow, that's
And what
brilliant.
Kind of response are you getting at this stage to the film?
You know, a pretty good one. It jumped right onto iTunes, and we I think we're a little mislabeled. We're in horror, but we were number six in horror right away. And
there's nothing wrong with
American
us.
So I'm hoping that as we get closer to, you know, Halloween's coming up, and I think the title is helping us, and... I just keep hearing the word charming, you know, in reviews, and I think we're starting to be reviewed well, and that warms the heart. So
you mentioned you were
very very pleased with it.
So you mentioned your surprise it's in horror. So what do you think the film is?
I mean, I think it's a romantic. I would say it's a comedy, then it's a romance, then it's a horror, because I don't think our zombies look particularly great, and I don't even actually love zombie movies myself. I'm more made kind of a, you know, a gateway drug for a horror enthusiast. Like a, you know, I wanted a movie that a guy who loves, you know, just to generalize here for a minute, a guy who loves horror might show his wife or girlfriend, like, hey, here's some starter horror for you. But it's really not very gory. It's not very scary. It's mostly a good laugh. And with some genuine romance, I think.
Yes.
It's really interesting because just before you came on, we were talking about genre and what genre means, and you know, is it good to mix and match and stuff. So it's really interesting that you set out to write a romantic comedy that just happened to have zombies in. Just cool.
I really like genre blends and genre mashups, and it's funny. What I've been hearing my entire career is that, unfortunately, the studios really dislike that because they get nervous. The marketing people get nervous. Like, well, wait, you're blending comedy and horror. How are we gonna market this? And you know, I just want to point out, you know, Shaun of the Dead and then Men in Black. I'm like, come on, you guys have done this before, but
you have to give them a little
nervous,
triplet there, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They like knowing something is a definite horror or a definite comedy.
They do,
and
that's true.
And I personally love watching and making the blends. I just think they're super fun. So,
Thank you so much. Kyle.
Oh, yeah, I saw your... It was so great to see that people were enjoying it. So thank you.
And especially over here in England, you know, people you've never heard of before suddenly tweeting about your film. That must have been extremely pleasing. I know I feel like that when anyone tweets about my novels.
Well, hopefully you'll come on and tell us all about the next films and stuff, and you keep making some fantastic cross-genre fare for us to all enjoy.
And we're all going to be looking out to see what you're up to next, Kyle. Thank you so much.
Yes, and thank you. Thanks so much for getting the word out.
You're welcome.
All right.
that was Burn Witch Burn, a bit of Radiohead, which is very, very appropriate now, isn't it, David?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we're going to go on to David's film of the month, and we're talking at the moment about a recommendation that George gave us last month, which is called...
That's right. George came up with a film last month and said, why don't we watch this one? So we thought, fantastic. It's a 1962 film called Night of the Eagle, but it has another title of Burn Witch Burn. The Radiohead track is actually Burn the Witch. And if you look that up on certainly online services, you'll find a fantastic video, which is all based around Camberwick Green and Trumpton, with little people wandering around doing the Wicker Man. It's absolutely awesome. I've never seen anything quite like it. It's fantastic. So Night of the Eagle, a 1962 film directed by Sidney Hayes. It's got a script by the powerhouse trio, really. Charles Beaumont, Richard Matheson, and George Baxt. And with those guys involved, boy, it had better be a good film. And indeed, Night of the Eagle is a fantastic film. It's based on a 1943 Fritz Lieber novel called Conjure Wife, which kind of gives you a bit of a clue, really, as to what the film's actually about. And we have Peter Wingard playing Norman Taylor as a psychology professor. And his wife, Tansy, played by Janet Blair, who's a practicing kind of white witch, I suppose, or or some such. So she's trying to kind of keep this Norman Taylor from harm, but he doesn't believe any of it. And he finds this stuff in his house and browns it up and burns it. And she's like, oh, my God, you can't burn it. Leave it, leave it. It's fine, it's fine, it's fine. Leave it, leave it. And the film kind of progresses. And as soon as she's got rid of all of this stuff, things start to go wrong. He gets accused of rape, he gets threatened with violence, and his life basically starts to fall apart here. And Tansy decides to sort of try and take his place because she realizes that somebody's after him. And the film kind of progresses. One of the things that I really liked about the film is the cinematography. I think it's a beautiful film. It's a black and white film, and it does one of those things that seldom is done in black and white films but should have been done so much more. It makes such great use of light and shadow and movement and mood through just not seeing things as much as seeing what's going on. And the way that the film cuts together and the way that it works, there's a sequence where he goes into a graveyard and into a kind of like an old castle. And you could almost feel the dust on the walls and the cobwebs. And it just looks so genuine in the way that it's been set and lit. And it's absolutely beautiful film. And I really did enjoy watching it. I'm just looking here. I again looked up online and stuff just to find out a bit about it. The writers are fans of the novel and they wanted to do it. But they were paid $5,000 each to write it. For AIP, they agreed to do it, and then it kind of went through, and the script was published in a book of Matheson's work. It took 6 weeks to film, which I still think is amazing that you could actually make a film in 6 weeks. It's absolutely incredible. Peter Cushing was originally meant to star, but was doing Captain Clegg, which we saw, Night Creatures, instead, and Janet Blair, who apparently is a musical comedy star.
Wow.
Came on board. But yeah, so I really enjoyed the film, and I thank George for mentioning it. So, George, you presumably a big appreciation of the film as well.
Yeah, I think this is probably my fourth viewing of the film from over the years. It's a film I discovered about 6-7 years ago, and I love how understated the whole thing is. It's, you know, the witchcraft thing is this undercurrent throughout the whole film, and it's almost like you're on the journey with Peter Wingard's character, who doesn't believe in it, but has to come to terms with the fact that there's this reality that he's not aware of, bubbling away, and it's not just his wife, but his wife's battling these dark forces and these, you know, in an academic setting as well, which is it's a really interesting choice.
So did you get to see it as well, Robin?
I did indeed. It was a film that I'd heard about over the years, but I'd never actually seen. Until George's recommendation, and I think that you nailed it there, George. Its power is it's the fact that it's understated. it actually reminded me a lot of the old Val Lewton movies.
Mm. Yes, you know, Cat People and stuff like that.
Cat People, yeah. I Walked with a Zombie and all those. It's absolutely tremendous. And what a performance from Peter Wingard.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You wouldn't recognise him from, like, Jason King and stuff, would
no,
you?
No,
you really wouldn't.
But, you know, oddly enough, I noticed that one of the producers was Albert Fennell, one of the guys with Brian Clemens who went on to do The Avengers, or, in fact, 62.
And I also saw Julian Wintle's name at the start. He was also involved with The Avengers.
And, you know, the opening scenes in the village and the sports car, it had that 60s Avengers feel to it.
Absolutely, yes.
It's probably one of the things that first attracted me to it, actually, because I'm such a fan of that kind of aesthetic of the Avengers, really. And it does have that kind of British village, black and white thing.
Patricia?
Yes. I saw it, and I really thought it was very interesting. I really liked the writing and the story of it, and how what's really going on isn't... And the actual villain isn't revealed until near the end, and about when you figure out why it's actually called Night of the Eagles, you're like, what, there are no eagles in the... Oh, okay.
But they focus on the stone eagles quite a lot throughout the film.
They do. But we could name this the window building where the studio is. If we were making a movie about the stone tapes and we called it the window building, is where you kind of...
But perhaps Burn Witch Burn was more appropriate to the title anyway.
It was a slightly more inflammatory title.
But Night of the Eagle is kind of a spoiler, though, isn't it?
A little bit,
Well, it is and it isn't, but the first thing I thought when George mentioned it was Night of the Eagle, I thought, oh, what is it, one of those war films? That's what I thought it would, you know, where we were going.
I've got a thought as well that another one of my favourite films, Dario Argento's Suspiria. And there's a whole sequence in there where a stone eagle comes alive and attacks a guy in the square, if you've seen Suspiria.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I really do wonder if Dario Argento had seen this film and been influenced by it.
Well, now everybody knows what the end is.
Yeah,
but you can't spoil a film that's 40 years old.
Yeah, but you don't know who the villain is. You don't know who the villain is. That's the thing.
Yeah,
but it's interesting. Have you ever seen Night of the Demon?
Yes.
Another classic.
Yes. Oh, I love that film.
And again, I think one of the reasons I picked up Night of the Eagle was because I thought, you know, similar title. And actually it's quite thematically similar as well, isn't it?
That's black and white as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's the demon,
similar era.
I mean, from my point of view, I thought it was an incredibly well-written story, obviously, with all of those serious writing it, not surprising. I don't like black and white films. I'm constantly saying that, but I did really enjoy this. I loved
the
I really don't. Most of the time, I do not like black and white films anymore. I used to love them. I don't anymore. I've got a real thing
I'm
about
trying
it.
To convert her. I'm trying
and,
to convert her.
And I think it's mostly because David shows me some really terrible ones, but we won't go there.
But in order to appreciate class like Night of the Eagle, you have to have sat through all of the really, really rubbish ones.
Plan 9 from outer space.
If you say so. If you say so, Dave. But it was it had a very noir feel as well because of that, because of the beautiful cinematography as well, I think. And there was that wonderful undercurrent of, I like the juxtaposition of the academia and sort of the jealousy within that, because being an ex-teacher. I've seen all that in reality, so I thought that was very believable. Yes.
So are people really using witchcraft in the academia setting?
Apparently all the time.
In the craft?
In the craft, of course,
Well, that wasn't necessarily about school and academics. That was about revenge.
So our film, Night of the Eagle, I think absolute, probably a very sound 9 out of 10 for me for that one.
Oh, 9 out of 10, definitely.
Yeah. Me too.
9.5 for me.
Robin?
Awesome.
I'll give it an 8.
Okay.
Why, Robin? Why?
Don't answer that. Back to Sam.
Okay, well, I think that's it for us. What a wonderful show. Thank you, everybody. Thanks to George Mann, David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, Robin Pierce, our guest, Carl Rankin, who was a really lovely man, and, of course, as always, our producer, Alex Levchuk. Till next time. Speaks my name.
stronger, yeah.